lesson starts now.
Thanksgiving is a time to give thanks. But for many, the problematic history of the creation of this holiday casts a shadow on what Thanksgiving is supposed to represent. On Thanksgiving morning, on KBOO, we bring you Indigenous Voices on a Colonial Holiday. Tune in from 8 a.m. to noon for a series of special public affairs programs, including a conversation with local activist and founding member of Eradicating Offensive Native Masketry, Jacqueline Keeler. We will also hear the voices of Dr. David Lewis and Dr. Michael Yellowbird. We'll talk about history, politics, education, food, and how to decolonize Thanksgiving.
Join KBOO at the Clinton Street Theater for our monthly movie screening night. This month, KBOO proudly presents Alice's Restaurant, the film based on a song based on Arlo Guthrie's 1965 Thanksgiving Day. Alice's Restaurant will screen Wednesday, November 26th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information about the film at KBOO at the Clinton series can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under the community events.
You can get anything you want at Alice's Restaurant.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Good morning. Here's what we have coming up for you on KBOO this morning. Coming right up, it's Political Perspectives. Glenn Greenwald interviews James Risen, the New York Times Pulitzer Prize winner, about the government's attempt to imprison him, profiteering in the war on terror, and his radicalization process. And later in the hour, we'll hear another reaction to the failure to indict police officer Darren Wilson from Vernalia Randall, emeritus professor of law at the University of Dayton and the author of the book Dying While Black. At 10 o'clock, Air Cascadia is off today. We'll hear Flashpoints featuring American Indian Movement founder Bill Means speaking out against the racist use of Indian culture and names by professional sports teams. Also from the archives, an interview with a Native American who was roughed up and detained during a San Francisco Giants game on Native American Heritage Night. At 11 o'clock on the Recovery Zone, host Stephanie Potter speaks with professor and writer Mike Beekoff about our need to reconnect with our natural landscapes and with animals, and also about his book, Rewilding Our Hearts. And we thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can easily become one when you go to kboo.fm and clicking right where it says Donate Today. We encourage you to do that. We love to have members, new members, at kboo.fm. Okay, we're going to get right to Political Perspectives this morning. Glenn Greenwald speaking with James Risen starts us off this morning.
I'm Ian Masterson. This is Background Briefing. And let's hear a conversation now provided by The Intercept between Glenn Greenwald, the first reporter who was given access to the trove of information provided by NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden, and the New York Times Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter James Risen, who the White House is trying to jail, the author of Payne Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War.
This is Glenn Greenwald with The Intercept, and I am speaking today with Jim Risen, the Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter for The New York Times, who has released a new book, the title of which is Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. Hey, Jim, thanks so much for taking some time to talk to me.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. So, you know, I've read your entire book, and I have several questions about it, beginning with a general one, which is, There have been a lot of books written about the failures of the War on Terror, deceit kind of embedded with the War on Terror, most of which have kind of taken the war on its own terms and critiqued it because of strategic failures or a failure to sort of achieve the claims that have been made to justify the war. And I actually have written a couple books myself about the War on Terror from that perspective. Yours is really one of the first that has focused on a particular part of the War on Terror, namely the way in which economic motives, what you call the Homeland Security Industrial Complex, has driven a huge part of the war. And there's a lot of new reporting about how that functions. And I wanted to ask you two things about that. One is that something that you intended to do, that you set out to do when you began writing the book? And if so, what led you to do that? And then the second part of it is, how much of this economic motive do you think is the cause of the fact that we've now been at war for 13 years, as opposed to kind of traditional war objectives like increasing domestic power or asserting foreign influence? How big of a role do you think it actually plays?
That was my goal. That was one of the key objectives of writing the book, and I think it plays in a really central role in why the war is continuing. I think it's basically after so many years, there's a whole class of people that have developed, post 9/11 mercenary class that's developed, that have invested in their own lives an incentive to keep the war going. Not just people who are making money, but people who are in the government who are also kind of their status and their power within the government are invested in continuing the war. So I was trying to show that it wasn't just greed. It was partly greed, but it was also status and power and ambition that all kind of are intertwined to make it so that there's very little debate about whether to continue the war and whether we should have any real reassessment on a basic level. So I was trying to, you're right, I was trying to get at those motivations. I was trying to understand how we could have this long, you know, prolonged period of war with such little debate. And I think it's both economic incentives and personal power incentives and ambition and status.
Well, let's talk about the economic part of the motive, because obviously one of the most striking things about the war is not just its duration, but the fact that it's continued essentially unimpeded, notwithstanding these wild swings in election outcomes. You know, you had the Republicans, who sort of were in power when the war commenced, get smashed in 2006 and then 2008 as a result of, at least primarily as a result of, dissatisfaction with the war in Iraq and just the general state of things. But then you had, you know, the war continue under a president who kind of vowed to rein it all in. And then even when the Democrats get killed in 2010 and then again in 2014, there's no signs of any of this letting up. You know, it's easy to see why there's this private sector, you know, the weapons manufacturers and the defense contractors, sort of the General Dynamics, Booz Allen world, that want the war to continue. I mean, they do really well when they're selling huge amounts of machinery and weapons and drones. But what causes the political class to be so willing to just serve their interests so brazenly, even when public opinion is so overwhelmingly against it?
That's a question I've struggled with myself. I've tried to understand. I think we had one or two real moments when we could have gone in a different direction. The primary one was, of course, 2008. I think Obama had a chance. He had a mandate to do something different, and he didn't do it. And I think part of it was that he was never exactly what we thought he was. He was never as liberal as people thought he was. I think a lot of voters kind of invested in him what their hopes and dreams without realizing exactly what he really was. I think he was always more conservative than he presented himself in 2008. To give him, you know, one little bit of the benefit of the doubt, I think it's very easy for the intelligence community to scare the hell out of politicians when they come in. And I think that Obama probably got seduced a little bit by the intelligence community when he arrived. And all you have to do is look at a lot of raw intelligence to scare somebody. convince them that it's much worse than you ever realized. But at the same time, he must take some of the blame. He surrounded himself with a lot of the Bush people from the get-go. You know, Brennan was on his campaign. Most of his team had some ties to the Bush years in the war on terror. And so to me, that's the hardest thing to really sort out is the factors that led Obama at that one moment. I think there was one opportunity at the end of 2008 to make a real significant change, and he didn't do it. Well, I think historians are going to be struggling with that for a long time.
Well, let me struggle with that with you a little bit because, I mean, the idea, and I think it's a commonly expressed one, there's probably some element of truth to it that, you know, a new president who doesn't really have a great level of experience with the military or the intelligence community has these like impressive generals and, you know, CIA people coming in with medals on their chest and decades of experience and as you say, purposely scaring them. But, you know, at the same time, like anybody who's remotely sophisticated about the world understands that that's going to happen, right? I mean, right, Dwight Eisenhower warned of the military-industrial complex, you know, 50 years ago. And you know that there are factions in Washington who maintain their power by scaring you. And you have your own advisors who kind of are there to... I mean, if you and I know that so much of that is fear-mongering, he has to know, right? I mean...
Right. And I think... I'm not trying to excuse it at all. In fact, I think it's what he wanted. My own gut tells me that what he decided to do was in early 2009 decide to focus on economic and healthcare policies, and that in order to do those things on the domestic side, that he had to protect his flank on national security and not fight the Republicans on national security. And so I think there was a calculated move by Obama to prolong the war on terror in order to try to focus on domestic issues. And I think after a while that he lost control of that narrative.
Mm. Yeah. It's always hard to talk about somebody's motives, right? I mean, I think we have a hard time knowing our own motives, let alone, people's who are complicated. But it's not just kind of and as you say, I mean, he had this great opportunity in 2008 because things like closing Guantanamo and reigning in the war on terror and stopping torture, these were all things that he ran on and won.
Right.
You've been really outspoken about the fact that it's not just the continuation of the Bush national security agenda, but even especially rather the escalation of the attack on journalism. You know, and I've seen you have some pretty extreme quotes about that. Like he's the worst president, I think you've said on press freedom since at least Nixon, maybe worse. Do you think that's a byproduct of just the fact that every president gets progressively worse, or do you think there's something unique and specific about his worldview and approach that has made him so bad on those press freedom issues?
Basically, what I believe is that one of his biggest legacies is going to be that on a broad scale, he normalized the war on terror. He took what Bush and Cheney had started kind of on an emergency ad hoc basis and turned it into a permanent state. And he allowed it to grow much more dramatically than it ever had under Bush or Cheney. And part of that, I think within that, was his attack on whistleblowers and journalists. Because I think it's all part and parcel of the same thing. If you believe in the national security state in the way Obama does, then you have to also believe in squashing dissent.
Hmm. And yeah, I mean, I think that's part of what makes war so degrading, right, for a political culture and a country, is it always gets accompanied by those kinds of things. So let me ask you a little bit about your own personal experience as part of that war on whistleblowing and journalism. I know you're a little constrained because your case is still pending. But one of the things I always find so interesting is whenever your case is talked about, it always gets talked about as in this very narrow sense, that you had a source for a story that you published in your book about some very kind of inept and ultimately counterproductive attempts to infiltrate the Iranian nuclear program, and that the case is about trying to force you to reveal your source, and like every good journalist should, you refuse to do so and therefore face a possibility of being held in contempt of court and then being sent to prison. But the background of your case that I want to just step back and talk about a little bit is that you've kind of had this very adversarial relationship with the intelligence community, this increasingly adversarial relationship with the intelligence community, as a result of a lot of the reporting that you did, including exposing the warrantless NSA program in 2005, for which you won the Pulitzer Prize. Can you talk about that, the kind of tensions that you've had with the government in the war on terror reporting that you've done, and how that has manifested and kind of affected your life?
Yeah, sure. In fact, I think I've said in affidavits in the case that I believe that the reason they came after me on this subpoena is because of the NSA stories that we did for the New York Times. I'm convinced, and I believe there's a lot of evidence to show that they decided ultimately not to come after the New York Times on the NSA stories, and instead wanted to try to isolate me by looking at something in my book. In fact, I know for a fact that they conducted leak investigations of at least three or four chapters, separate chapters in my book. They interviewed a lot of people about totally unrelated things to the case that they ultimately came after me on. And I think they were looking for something in my book to isolate me from the New York Times. And in their court papers, they have repeatedly cited the fact that the New York Times decided not to run the story as one of the arguments for why it's justified for them to come after me on it. I pride myself on the fact that I developed an adversarial relationship with the government, because I think that's what every reporter should do.
You know, I know from my own experience in doing the NSA reporting over the past 18 months that, you know, like I've heard you say before, that, you know, you're not going to let these kind of threats and these recriminations affect your reporting. That was definitely my mindset as well. And I was actually even more determined a lot of times whenever I felt threatened to do the reporting even more aggressively to make sure that those bullying tactics weren't going to work. At the same time, you know, when you hear kind of top level government officials openly kind of muse about the crimes that you've committed, when you hear privately through your attorney that the Justice Department might arrest you when you come back to the U.S., of course, it does have an effect on you. It occupies a mental space. Sure. It, you know, you spend a lot of your time talking to your lawyers instead of right. focusing on journalism. And, you know, one of the things I've always found so fascinating about your case is, you know, you have a Pulitzer, you work for the New York Times, you're one of the best known investigative journalists in the country, one of the most institutionally protected, even though they did separate you from the Times by focusing on your book. Still, though, the fact that they were able to target you this way for this many years, I thought was a really powerful message that if we can even go after Jim Risen, we can go after anybody. I know you want to maintain the idea, and I know that it's true that none of this consciously deterred you from doing the journalism. But how does being at the center of a case like this, where people are openly talking about you going to prison, including people in the Justice Department, how does that have an effect on your journalism, on your relationship to your sources, just on your ability to do your work?
Well, you know, it's interesting. It affected me a lot at first, for the first couple of years. People kind of, you know, it's one of those weird things that I'm sure you know now. These things go on forever, and they take a long time, and most of the time nobody's paying any attention except you and your lawyers. And it's during the first several years, nobody paid much attention, and it did have an effect on me then. And it took a long time, really, for me to kind of realize I've got to just keep going. It did affect me quite a bit at first. But the fact that now a lot of people are supporting me has really helped me this year in particular. In the last 6 months to a year, when I've gotten a lot more attention and people supporting me, I've realized that now it's more of a – I feel like now I have to represent the industry, represent the profession. And so it's kind of changed the way I even think about the case.
You have become this kind of prolific, increasingly prolific user of Twitter out of nowhere. You were never on Twitter. You're a very late joiner. I clearly see the signs of addiction forming. And I say that as somebody who recognizes it personally. And you've kind of evolved from, like, you had a Twitter egg for a long time. You now actually have, like, a real picture. One of the things I find
fascinating. My son took that picture.
All right, well. I knew it was going to be somebody else who caused you to leave the egg behind. But one of the things that I find really interesting is Twitter is sort of a venue where you get to speak in a different way about different things than you do, say, in an article or that you write for the New York Times, right? Where you're a little bit more constrained in how you're talking. And you've expressed some ideas that I think are very rare for, you know, somebody who is a reporter at a large establishment institution like the New York Times to express. You had this sort of multi-part tweet maybe about a month ago that was focused on the question. It almost sounded like something Noam Chomsky might say or other people might say like that, that sort of the big plague of establishment thought in the U.S. is a fear of deviating from conventional wisdom. And it's only, you know, sort of a generation or two later when people who do that get vindicated. And so there's this really strong incentive not to do that. Can you elaborate on the kinds of things you were talking about and what you've experienced that led you to see those things?
Yeah, well, that was in part of a speech I gave at Colby College. I think it's the best thing I've written on this whole issue. I compared how Elijah Lovejoy, who was an abolitionist in the 1830s, who was murdered because he was trying to run a newspaper in St. Louis that was pro-abolitionism, how he was so far ahead of his time that people thought he was crazy. And he was so far outside the mainstream that people thought abolitionism and the end of slavery was this idea that was insane. And I was trying to compare that to what we'd have today, where anybody who says we shouldn't have a war on terror is considered delusional. And I was trying to show that conventional wisdom is a creature of our time. It's not inherently true or not true. And that the mainstream press's kind of dependence on conventional wisdom ultimately cripples it in a lot of different ways.
The impression that I have, and I mean, I've known you personally only for a few years, so it's more just kind of a speculative observation from having seen your work before that, is that a combination of your going through this case with the government where your own liberty is very much at risk as a result of the government's actions, combined with a lot of the reporting that led to this book, kind of has radicalized you in a way that I think is a pretty common thing that a lot of people in the war on terror have gone through, where people look at their country differently, much more so than they ever did before, look at institutions differently. Am I right about that? Is like the Jim Risen of today more willing to sort of experiment with novel ideas that aren't conventional than, say, the Jim Risen of 20 years ago as a result of those experiences?
Probably. I have to think about that. I think I'm trying to think back. I think that my real change came after 9/11 and the invasion of Iraq. I was covering the CIA as a beat then. And it was fascinating because talking to CIA people in right after the invasion of Iraq and right before the invasion of Iraq it was kind of like privately talking to a bunch of Howard Deans. They were all radicalized against what Bush was doing. And to me, it was wild to hear all these people inside the intelligence community, especially in 2003, 2004, who were just going nuts. They couldn't believe how the radical change that the United States was going through and that nobody was opposed to it. And that led me to write my last book, State of War, because I was hearing things from within the intelligence community and the U.S. government that you weren't hearing, you know, publicly from anybody. And so that really led me to realize and to step back and look at the radical departure of U.S. policy that has happened since 9/11 and since the invasion of Iraq, which I think – To me, it's not like I've been radicalized. I think the country, maybe I'm wrong, but I kind of feel like I stayed in the same place and the country changed. The country became more radicalized in a different direction.
Yeah, you know, I wonder about that a lot. You know, I think obviously, you know, I started writing about politics in 2005 and a huge part of that was that perception that the country had radically changed, the things that we took for granted were no longer the case. And I've definitely had a very kind of rapid and significant evolution in my views of how I look at those things, the more I kind of focus on them and the more the country changed. But if you go back and look at some, you know, kind kind of media critics of the 50s and 60s, people like I.F. Stone or others, who were kind of placed on the outside of conventional wisdom and were viewed as, you know, sort of fringe or crazy at the time. A lot of that critique can be found way before 9/11, you know, lies about the Vietnam War, the huge military industrial complex around the Cold War. Do you think the 9/11 was this kind of radical break from how things were done in the country, or was it more just kind of a injection of steroids into processes that had already been underway?
Well, it's possible. I mean, yeah, I mean, there's always been problems, but I just think that we've taken this to a new level, both because the technology has allowed the government to do things it could never have done before, but also just because of the willingness of the country to accept security measures and the reduction in civil liberties that I think would not have been contemplated before.
Yeah.
And that's that to me is – I keep thinking, you know, if you had a Rip Van Winkle from 1995 who woke up and today, I don't think they would really recognize the country. And that to me is kind of what I'm trying to write about and what I view, because that's the America that I remember.
Yeah, I mean, there's this fascinating debate that took place in the 90s where after the Timothy McVeigh attack on the Oklahoma City courthouse, the Clinton administration introduced these proposals to require backdoors into all encryption for all computers and internet usage. And it didn't happen. And the reason it didn't happen is because all these Republicans in Congress led by John Ashcroft stood up with a bunch of Democrats in alliance with them saying we're not going to be the kind of country that gives the government access to all of our communications. Privacy is actually a crucial value. And just a few short years later, all of that reversed and that debate became, you know, inconceivable.
You know, I think when Dick Cheney said, you know, the gloves come off, that was a really – I don't think we realized how important that was and what that really meant. That, as I've said before, that really meant we're going to deregulate national security and we're going to take off all the rules that we that were imposed in the 70s after Watergate. And that was just a dramatic change in the way we conduct foreign policy and national security. And I think it's been extended to a – you know, this whole new homeland security apparatus. People think that terrorism is an existential threat, even though it's not. And so they're willing to go along with all this. And that's what's so scary to me.
Well, let me ask you a few questions about some specific examples in your book, including one that relates to what you just said, which is you kind of have these different wars that you conceive of, and one of them is what you call a war of normalcy. And one of the examples is there's this area in the U.S.-Canadian border that used to be kind of tranquil, and now there's a ton of war on terror money that has gone to the state police there, and it's kind of just militarized that zone and made it, you know, so the citizens are just interfered with in all kinds of ways. One of the most overlooked trends, I think, is that all of these, you know, what you were just talking about with Cheney taking the gloves off, all of these things that we were doing overseas aimed at, you know, ostensibly foreign terrorists, have now begun to be imported onto U.S. soil, right? Like the militarization of our police force using techniques from Baghdad, the use of drones, you know, collected all. The NSA motto was first pioneered by Keith Alexander in Baghdad. Now it's aimed at U.S. citizens. Do you think that's an important trend? Is that something that you think is really happening, that what was the war on terror aimed outward is now being aimed domestically?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's one of the most scary elements of it is to me, when the NSA started spying domestically, that was like, you know, Caesar crossing the Rubicon. It was a really important shift that, you know, the NSA people always thought was absolutely forbidden. And when the NSA started doing it, and then when you started fooling around with you know, creating a new Department of Homeland Security, with merging all these departments, like, you know, creating ICE and all this stuff, I think you've created a much more efficient federal domestic law enforcement apparatus. And efficiency is not necessarily always a good thing when it comes to that. So,
well,
I mean, I think one of the things I always think about it. I wrote a book. One of my earlier books was about comparing the CIA and the KGB in the Cold War. And I always remember somebody telling me that the only countries that have really efficient security services are dictatorships.
Right, right. And you can basically only have a really efficient dictator's security service if you're willing to at least kind of go into that realm of authoritarianism. They kind of go hand in hand.
Right, right.
There's this pretty new reporting that you have on General Atomics, which is the maker of drones. And you describe them as the new oligarchs. In 2001, they had $100 million in government contracts, and now in 2012, they have $1.8 billion.
Yeah.
Just
yeah.
Obscene increase. And at the same time, coincidentally enough, you cite a good government group documenting that they've spent more to fund congressional staff travel than any other company.
Right, right.
One of the things that always amazes me, I remember there was this reporting that was done by Wired during the debate over whether to give immunity to the telecoms that participated in the NSA program that you uncovered. You know, an extraordinary right. thing to do, to retroactively immunize the biggest companies in the United States. And Jay Rockefeller became the leading spokesman for it at the time. He was the Democratic chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee. And there were these studies showing that right around the time that he became the leading proponent of telecom immunity, AT&T and Verizon and Sprint began donating lots of money to his campaign. They threw parties for him. But still, in the context of right. Jay Rockefeller, a Rockefeller with a super safe seat mm-hmm. in West Virginia, they were pretty trivial amounts to be able to just dominate
right.
congressional right. policy that way. And that is what struck me, too, about General Atomics. I mean, so they fund some congressional staff travel. What is it about the DC culture that lets these kind of seemingly trivial amounts in the scheme of things end up translating into this massive influence?
You know, I don't think that's the money that really does the trick. I think what really you've got to look at is these all the staffers and a lot of the members of Congress are looking for what are they going to do after they leave those jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And also the same is true for military officers. What are you going to do when you retire from the military or from the House Intelligence Committee or whatever? You're going to need a job at a defense contractor. And so I think that the real incentive for a lot of these people is not to upset their potential employers in the future. And that the campaign contributions themselves are just tokens, as you said.
To say that, it seems in on one hand to be kind of almost self-evident, but on the other hand, it's a pretty extraordinary observation because it's a form of the most extreme corruption, right? Like public officials right. are serving the interest of really rich corporations in exchange for lucrative private sector jobs that they get when they leave after serving their interests.
Well, you know, it's really hit me home on when I was working on I have a chapter on KBR, and one of the guys who I describe was kind of a whistleblower, Charles Smith. He was an auditor for the Army who tried to stop about $1 billion in payments to KBR because they didn't have any proof that they had actually spent the money, or they didn't have sufficient records to prove it. And he lost his job over his fight with KBR, he believes. And after I started talking to him, he said, well, there's this one general you could talk to who was one of my bosses for a while. He was a good guy and he would vouch for me. So I called that general who had since retired. And he said, well, I think Charlie was a great guy, but I now work for a contractor that does business with KBR, and I don't want to say anything publicly about Charlie because that might upset KBR. Mm.
Yeah, it's...
And that's the kind of thing that you see all the time.
There's a case that you talk about in the book. It's Burnett versus Albaraka, where 9/11 families sued the Saudis. There are lots of influential people in D.C. who, like Senator Bob Graham, the former head of the Senate Intelligence Committee, or Senate Armed Services Committee, rather, and others who have said that the role that the Saudis have played in the war on terror and specifically in the 9/11 attack has been actively suppressed because of the U.S. alliance with Saudi Arabia. And there is this sort of bizarre aspect that we've gone to war against a huge number of countries, one of the few exceptions to which has been the country that had the most nationals involved in that attack and whose government you know, has been the most persuasively implicated. How persuasive or credible do you find those questions about the Saudi involvement in the war on terror generally, 9/11 specifically, and whether that's been actively suppressed?
Well, you know, as you said, I don't really get into the substance of that in the, right. in that chapter, because it's really about this bizarre operation and how crazy it that operation became. But I think you're right. I mean, this it's one of the unanswered questions of 9/11 that, as you said, Graham became fixated on, and they still have not unredacted that parts of that report. I think, you know, the role of the Saudi government is probably different from the role of wealthy people in the Persian Gulf. And that's the distinction that people have tried to grapple with for a long time. Is are these just individual wealthy people in the Gulf, either in Saudi Arabia or in the Emirates, or is there some direction from any of these governments? And that's the question that the U.S. government never has wanted to address publicly.
Right. You said in an interview within the last week, it might have been at the FDL book salon, I'm not sure exactly where it was, but you described the period of time in 2004 and 2005 when you were trying to get the story published reporting the NSA eavesdropping story as, quote, one of the most stressful times of your life. Or I think you even said the quote, most stressful period of your professional life. The New York Times, to its credit, did eventually publish that story and did a great job on it. But can you talk a little bit about what you meant by that, why that period was so stressful?
Yeah, I mean, it was Eric Lischblau and I were trying to get it in the paper from beginning in, I think, October 2004. And then they killed it, or they stopped it. They agreed with the White House not to run it before the election, and then we tried again after the election, and they killed it again. And that by that time, it was pretty well dead. And so I went on a book leave and decided to put it in my book. And I knew that by doing that, I was putting my career at the New York Times in jeopardy. And so it was very stressful about what was going to happen between me, the New York Times, and the Bush administration. And I really credit my wife more than anybody else. I told her at one point, if I do this, if I keep it in the book and the Times doesn't run it, I'm probably going to get fired. And I remember she told me, I won't respect you if you don't do that. And so that was enough for me to keep going. But I didn't sleep for about 6 months.
Yeah, I mean, it's got to be incredibly difficult knowing that you have a story of that magnitude, that the story has been nailed down and you just can't get it out into the world. Well, anyway, your book, which I literally finished reading about 24 hours ago, is really riveting. And it's not, a book that's just a polemical indictment of the war on terror like you've read before. It really is an incredible amount of original reporting on one of the most underreported aspects of this war, which is just how many people are gorging on huge amounts of profit and waste at the expense of the taxpayer, and how what a big part of the war that is. So congratulations on writing such a great book, and I really appreciate your talking to me.
Well, thank you.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. Bye for now.
And you were listening to Glenn Greenwald interviewing James Risen. And next, we're going to hear another reaction to the failure to indict police officer Darren Wilson from Vernelia Randall. She's emeritus professor of law at the University of Dayton and also the author of the book Dying While Black. That's coming right up.
I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Vernelia Randall, who is Emeritus Professor of Law at the University of Dayton in Ohio. Her writings are at her website, racism.org, and she is the author of the book Dying While Black. Welcome to Background Briefing, Vernelia Randall.
Thank you for having me.
And obviously, the aftermath of what happened with this grand jury decision from the prosecutor, or at least announced by the prosecutor, who appeared to me to be more of a defense attorney of the accused. And the job of prosecutors and grand juries is to actually get indictments, not to defend the person who is supposed to be indicted. If anybody got attacked or in that presentation, it seemed to be the victim, Michael Brown. That's my impressions. What were your impressions?
That was my impression as well. And I think, to tell you the truth, I teach race and racism in American law, taught it for 25 years, and I really didn't expect anything more than what happened from the point when he failed to indict to how he set up the grand jury process. There's a saying in the United States that a prosecutor can get a ham sandwich indicted if they want to. And so it's all about how you set up the process, and clearly he set up a process in order not to get an indictment, and then he defended that. He acted as a defense attorney in explaining that lack of an indictment.
So, in effect, the fix was in.
Yes.
So, what is your sense then of how, are there, in your experience as a professor of law, is there any examples where the police actually have been held to account?
The truth of the matter, in recent history, in the last 20, 30 years, there has been a significant change in how the law deals with police and police misconduct. And there has been one case where there was an indictment, and then the judge threw that out. Police almost never even go past their department discipline. When they go before a grand jury, grand juries almost never indict them, and that's largely because prosecutors and police work together. And if the prosecutor doesn't protect the police, we have elected prosecutors, and in our society, prosecutors get elected by being tough on crime. They need police cooperation.